This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour. I'm Anthony Scoma. Today on the program, a panel of experts discusses Utah's public lands and the gateway communities that provide access to them. The panel will lay out the problems and opportunities presented by the popularity of these areas and what Utah can do to maintain its natural wonders amidst historic population growth. One such issue that has garnered extensive public attention is the future of transportation in Little Cottonwood Canyon. Two public projects have gone before the Utah Department of Transportation to address the winter congestion caused by traffic to ski resorts. One idea is a 200-foot-tall, 8-mile-long gondola, the other an expansion of the existing canyon road to accommodate a fleet of buses. While UDOT's decision on the canyon infrastructure is waiting on a final environmental impact statement, the mayors of Salt Lake County, Alta, and Sandy have joined local interest and environmental groups to denounce the gondola as the solution to the canyon's problems. Critics of the gondola claim that the current $592 million price tag is a severe underestimate, and that the more accurate estimate would be closer to $1 billion. UDOT's estimate for the enhanced bus system is placed at $510 million. However, the maintenance cost of the expanded road system is projected to outstrip the gondola sometime around 2050. Due to the unprecedented scope of these projects, UDOT was unable to say if these costs are a high or low reflection of actual costs. This week's panel of experts will discuss areas like Little Cottonwood Canyon in Utah and across the western U.S. The panel includes Betsy Byrne, landscape architect at the National Park Service, Dita Seed, public land senior campaigner for the Center of Biological Diversity, Brian Steed, executive director of the Utah Department of Natural Resources, and Vicky Varela, managing director of the Utah Office of Tourism. Moderating today's panel is Danya Ramore, founder of the Gateway and Natural Amenity Region Initiative and professor at the S.J. Quinney College of Law. This forum was co-sponsored by the University of Utah's Office of Sustainability. This forum was recorded on April 11th, 2022. Here is your moderator, Danya Ramore.
As just introduced, I'm Danya Ramore, the director of the Wallace Stegner Center's Environmental Dispute Resolution Program. And it truly is a pleasure to get to moderate this panel today. I've had the opportunity to work with a number of these people, including people in the audience. And we really do have an all-star lineup of speakers. So just a quick overview of what to expect. In a moment, I'm going to give a little framing for our conversation today. And then I'm going to give each of the speakers 3 minutes. We've decided on 3 minutes to give some opening remarks. So we'll see if we can do it. I've told them if they're going long, I will sunset them. So watch for the sunset. And then we have a few questions I'm going to pitch to the panel to have some conversation around. And then things going as planned, we'll take a few questions from the audience, definitely the in-person audience, maybe the online audience as well. So with that, let me frame up our conversation today. I want to start by saying a little bit more about myself and how I got into working on gateway community public lands issues and some things, again, that might frame up our conversation today. So as indicated in the introduction, my main area of expertise is as a collaborative process designer. I do conflict resolution work. And through working as a collaborative professional, I was actually involved in facilitating collaborative regional planning around the Zion National Park area. About 6 years ago, I got involved. And through working in that area and other places like Moab, my home region of northern Idaho, I realized that gateway regions, those that have a lot of high quality natural amenities, whether it's a national park, big BLM lands, scenic rivers and lakes, that these communities and regions throughout the West were experiencing a lot of shared challenges. Everything from overwhelmed recreation infrastructure, acute housing affordability issues, impacts on natural resources, due to these places becoming increasingly desirable places to live and visit. And that led me and a team to launch a big research initiative in 2017 and 18, looking at how pervasive these issues are across Western gateway regions, as I will call them. And what we found in our research is that indeed, as of 2018, gateway regions throughout the West were becoming increasingly popular places to live and visit. And as a result of that, these regions were experiencing a suite of similar challenges. Everything from, as I said before, impacts on the natural resources, impacts on recreation infrastructure, and also things like impacts on wastewater infrastructure, overwhelmed wastewater systems due to the influx of people, Again, acute housing affordability issues. We have some really striking numbers from our 2018 study about the pervasiveness of acute housing affordability issues across these regions. And also things like overwhelmed transportation systems, both around and in the public lands. So again, in 2018, with our study, we found that to be the case. That led us to launch an initiative which we call the Gateway and Natural Amenity Region, or GNAR, NAR initiative. For those of you who are bikers and skiers, you might get the NAR reference. We study the NAR and we shred the NAR. So we launched an initiative really officially in early 2020, in part because we saw COVID was driving increased visitation in these gateway regions, as well as people moving out of cities permanently, temporary, to these places to get away from big city life and COVID and all the things that were coming with that. So a few things I want to drive home based on my ongoing work with these regions that I hope will frame up our conversation today. Again, as of 2018, prior to COVID and all the things that have come with it, we were seeing these impacts in gateway regions across the West. And I mentioned some of the impacts we're seeing. As of 2020 and after, we're seeing those impacts and the increased visitation and growth basically put on steroids in a lot of these places. And I know people who have visited these regions may know what I'm talking about. And again, it's everything from the housing issues to the impacts on the natural resources. Another thing I really want to drive home is that these issues are interconnected across the communities and the public lands. So if there is not affordable housing in the gateway communities, it's really hard to have employees work in the federal lands because there's nowhere for them to live, right? And if people can't afford to live there and work there, then you have people who aren't basically managing the resource because they can't afford to live there, right? You have an employee problem. Additionally, the transportation issues that happen in the parks are spilling out into the communities, or what's happening in the communities is making it harder to get into the parks. And if you have overwhelmed parks or other public lands, you're seeing people spill over into other kinds of public lands, maybe your state parks, creating impacts in those other places. And often, let's say someone's come to recreate at a national park, but they can't get in or they can't get camping there, they may end up on Bureau of Land Management or state park land and not actually be prepared to disperse camp or to recreate sustainably in that particular place. So final thing I want to highlight before we really hand it over to the panelists is that because of the interconnectivity of these issues, I believe, and I'm a collaboration professional, so I'm influenced by that lens, but I think people really need to work together across borders and boundaries and interests to really address these issues. So I have a few questions for our panelists today that are kind of to that effect. So without further ado, I'm going to hand it over to our panelists. The way we're going to do this is I'm going to have each panelist go, just say a little bit more about themselves, and obviously 3 minutes isn't a lot of time, but a little bit more about themselves and then answer kind of a specific question. So a reminder, 3 minute speakers. Betsy, I'm going to have you go first. Again, if you'd tell us a little bit more about yourself and just the challenges and opportunities we see facing gateway regions, again, both the public lands and the gateway communities, and maybe you can give us some specific examples.
Yeah, you bet. Hi, Betsy. I work for the National Park Service, but I work for kind of an interesting program within the Park Service. It's the Rivers, Trails, and Conservation Assistance Program. And what we do is we support community-led outdoor recreation and conservation projects. And I don't have to have anything to do with the National Park Service unit. They just come to us and say, hey, we really want to work on a trail system, or we want to do some river restoration work, and you know, we need some help to get it done. And a big part of what we do is help, you know, we provide the role of sort of a connector or a convener or facilitator, connecting them to, you know, other local groups or the people of the county, people at the state, federal land managers, so that everyone's kind of working together on, you know, sort of developing solutions and, you know, resources for these projects. And I wanted to give you just kind of one example of something I'm working on right now. It's working with the Jemez National Recreation Area in New Mexico. It's with the Santa Fe National Forest. And sort of what they're seeing there is, you know, kind of as Danya alluded to, with the increase in visitation through COVID, they're seeing increased like dispersed camping issues. And that's causing impacts to the creek corridors. It's causing impacts to habitat for an endangered species, a jumping mouse species that they have there. It's, you know, there's trash, there's graffiti, there are unattended fire rings that, you know, make people really nervous about wildfire getting out of control. So that's kind of the host of issues that they're kind of seeing. And they want to get together a collaborative group that includes, there's a couple of Park Service units close by and they're not communicating very well together. The town of Jemez Springs, which is a little community with not many resources, but it's kind of the last stop as people travel up from Albuquerque to get into the forest. You know, they want to get together with, you know, nonprofits like Trout Unlimited, New Mexico Wild, and they want to work with the Puebloan people. This is their ancestral lands, and they live all around there. You know, it's not like they've been removed. That's where they're living, and they still use this land. And so, you know, there's all kinds of different kind of interests and perspectives and ways the people use this land, and they want to get together and kind of come up with some strategies, whether that's, you know, educating users who are coming up to the forest and, you know, how are they going to do that, to, you know, coming up with some management strategies. You know, are we going to, you know, designate this area for camping? Are we going to charge fees? You know, the Forest Service has limited staff capacity. What are ways that they can maybe partner with some of the other folks who are doing work in the region to, you know, cover some of those capacity issues? So that's just one project, and one of the ways that we try to work with people to kind of address these big problems by bringing lots of different interests and people to bear on it.
Thank you for that, Betsy. Dita, I'm going to pass it to you now to say again a little bit more about yourself and some specific challenges and opportunities related to public lands, particularly related to conservation and the 30 by 30 initiative, if you don't mind.
Yeah, so I work for the Center for Biological Diversity, and my portfolio of work is around protecting our public lands and even protecting our public lands from human impacts. and so the kinds of threats that we face right now on public lands go to issues around off-road vehicle use, really rampant, excessive off-road vehicle use that's churning up the soil, creating dust, destroying biodiversity, et cetera. So that's one kind of problem that we're working to address. Another problem is mineral extraction from public lands and fossil fuel extraction on public lands. Another set of problems go to things that public land managers sometimes do to try and protect public lands, but you know, end up creating harm, which is like vegetation treatments, where they go in and they'll literally churn the vegetation with these giant machines and shred it all, and it's designed to restore habitat, but the science is very unclear about whether that is actually the outcome. And some people argue, and some scientists argue, it's really about helping cattle grazing, which is also a thing that is very devastating to public lands. Just it is. And then harvesting timber is another issue. And so there are all these things that human beings do to public lands that are really creating a crisis that we're facing right now. I mean, we are facing a climate emergency, and it's incumbent upon us to do what we can to protect our public lands, to mitigate the harm from the climate crisis. And the kinds of things that scientists are talking about right now are really about putting affirmative protection on public lands, saying, you know, these lands will not be developed, these lands will not be used for resource extraction, these lands will not be driven over by 10,000 off-road vehicles. So there's a famous scientist, E.O. Wilson, he just died recently, but he came up with a concept called Half Earth. He wrote a book about it, and there's actually something called the Half Earth Foundation. And his thesis, which is backed by science, is that in order to prevent the harm from the climate emergency, we need to protect half of Earth's habitat intact for biodiversity and climate resilience. So when President Biden was campaigning, he agreed to a version of this proposal, which is called 30 by 30, protecting 30% of the United States' land and water by 2030 in order to preserve climate, or to help with climate resilience and to protect for biodiversity. So right after he took office, President Biden issued an executive order on the climate crisis at home and abroad, and in it he cited his 30 by 30 goal. So what does that mean for Utah? That means that Utah, that all of us, have the the opportunity to present to the Biden administration what we would like to see protected within the boundaries of the state. What waters and landscapes would you like to see protected? And we have this opportunity to present this at some point in the not too distant future to the Biden administration. And we're talking about administrative protection here. So these would be things the administration could do on its own without going to Congress. And so to that end, we have a coalition that we've formed called the Utah 30 by 30 Coalition, which is made up of a number of environmental organizations that you all probably would be familiar with. But anyway, that is what I am working on, protecting our public lands using this administrative tool called 30 by 30. The Biden administration also describes it as America the Beautiful.
Great, thank you for that, Dita. If you see me get kind of restless over here, that's
just to stop talking.
We all have so much to say. Okay, Brian, I'm gonna have you go next, and you have the pleasure of getting to manage these resources. And one thing I do wanna highlight for the audience and for our panelists is it's not all bad. Right? We love to enjoy these places. That's part of why we're having this conversation, is how do we protect the things that make these places, whether the lands or the community, special. So I just want to use that framing for our conversation. And Brian, you get the joy of getting to manage the lands or oversee those who do. So can you tell us a little bit about what the state agencies are doing to try to address some of these challenges, protect these places, and anything else you think is important for us to know?
Jeez. First of all, I want to say thanks so much for the opportunity to be here. I used to teach at Utah State, and I love interacting with students. It's one of my favorite things to do. I don't get the opportunity as much as I'd like to now, and so it's always good to be back here. And as to the University of Utah, I went to law school here, so I always get a little sick to my stomach coming here. Not because of the U itself, because law school was a little traumatic.
Love sitting next to law faculty, don't you?
Yeah, I really do. So I'm really happy to be here. As was mentioned, my current role, I'm the director of the Department of Natural Resources for the state. And there are 8 divisions and then 2 offices that are affiliated with that. But it's really broad ranging. And it's a lot of the things that Dita was talking about, you know, that her organizations are very concerned about. So oil, gas, and mining, that's one of the divisions we represent, or that are part of the DNR. In addition to that, we've got wildlife, we've got water rights, water resources. And in terms of this conversation, we have 2 really germane organizations. One is the Division of State Parks. The other is the Division, newly created, of Outdoor Recreation. And both of these are working really at the fore to kind of manage some of the real constraints that I think that we have seen. Over the past 3 years, we've seen huge increases in visitation, both on the national and state level. Unprecedented increases, and that has big impacts on landscapes. One of the first areas we saw this landscape being impacted on our world, and I didn't mention, we have another division called the Division of Forestry, Fire, and State Lands that manages state lands, and that's a really complicated thing. A bunch of lands were transferred out of underneath the Colorado River and were put right on the doorstep of Moab. It was the last free camping in Moab, and by free, it was by the finance you paid to get in there, but not the impact it was having on the environment. And when we looked at that, right on the doorstep of Arches National Park, we said we need to do better as a state. And so one of the newest created state parks is Utah Raptor State Park. It's named so because part of the area contained therein was Dalton Wells Dinosaur Quarry, where, you know, part of the area where Utah Raptors, the dinosaur, were found. But then in addition to that, it's just this great gateway into Arches that's off the beaten path. But we want to do that right as well, because as it was managed currently, I can tell you straight that there were Charmin lilies blooming everywhere. And what a Charmin lily is, I'm not going to get into, but it's not a lily. And the lily portion is mostly toilet paper. And it's pretty gross, and we want to make sure. So first thing we're doing is putting in a bunch of portable restrooms right now as we develop this state park. Second thing we're doing is developing additional hardened camping opportunities so that people are not recreating in such a way that it's damaging the outdoors. So we're working very closely with the Park Service to make sure that we are working in concert. One of the major concerns that we have in that area is, where do you house park rangers? And Moab has the same, Arches and Canyonlands have the exact same problem, because you cannot afford housing in Moab right now. And there's not a lot of great places. So one of the things we've been in active conversations about is maybe developing facilities where we can share housing for both federal and state park rangers to make sure that there is a place to stay that's affordable. Lastly, I want to talk briefly about this new division of outdoor recreation. The state has had an Office of Outdoor Recreation for a number of years. We were the first. Recently, that was combined into a new division in a DNR called the Division of Recreation. And then this past legislative session, outdoor recreation and the Division of Recreation were merged. Yeah, and what's cool about that is it gives a ton more resources. Part of what we do on that is outdoor recreation grants, which have been about $25 million worth of those grants to try to disperse recreation. Because what we find on some of these gateway communities is people congregate in one place, and there are a bunch of different places you could go, but by congregating in that one place, you're really pounding that one place and trying to avoid some of those negative outcomes from that tourism industry. And then we're just working on a variety of different initiatives around the state with that new resource. The state also invested a new $49 million fund this year on specifically outdoor recreation endeavors, and that will be an ongoing, it's actually a dedicated portion of state income tax, and it will be pretty impactful in getting things together. And we are increasing our ability to manage on both state resources and helping the federal agencies get resources they need. Because oftentimes, I know you've all been to Trailhead, and there's not a place to park, there's not a place to use the restroom. We would love as a state to help some of those areas so that we can minimize those impacts. Thanks.
Great. Thank you, Brian. I hadn't heard the Charmin Lily, is that what it is?
Yeah, Charmin
Lily.
We
call them toilet paper blossoms. Not funny, but the term is funny. Vicki, I'm going to have you go now. Just tell us a little bit about yourself and really interested to hear more about what the Office of Tourism is doing, as well as just any again other thoughts you have building on what others have said.
Excellent. I do love being here at the university. You're all privileged to be a part of this Hinckley Institute. There's a wonderful, rich tradition. So the Red Emerald Strategic Plan, I don't think it's a household name. Yeah, you probably haven't heard of it. But the Red Emerald Strategic Plan is the driving strategy for the Utah Office of Tourism. To build a perpetual visitor economy. And it represents a completely different way of organizing everything we do at the Utah Office of Tourism than what we did when I came into the role 9 years ago. In order to build a perpetual tourism economy, we have to be really thoughtful. The Red Emerald is a rare stone that's mined only in Utah, and that embodies what we want the Utah visitor economy to be, which is a highly sought after, highly valued experience, both for hosting communities and for visitors. We are not in the volume business. We know people love Utah. What we want to do is attract the quality visits that will serve our communities well. The type of visitors that will get off the beaten path, that will immerse themselves in our local communities and in meaningful adventure exploration. The type of visitors that will come back over and over, because visitors that come back over and over understand and respect our fragile environments. We're trying to do all that we can to ensure that we protect the quality of life for all of us as the hosting communities, and that our visitors follow the principles of leave no trace, tread lightly, the challenges of archaeological vandalism that we've all heard about. So we have really strong partnerships with the experts in all of those areas to help us figure out how to have well-prepared visitors. A couple of examples, I've worked with Danya for years, and our philosophy is we've got to lean into all the hard issues that Danya is raising through NAR. Thank you. We've got to have, I'm reading a book called Leading with Emotional Courage. We've got to have the emotional courage to engage in these discussions and figure out the right answers. So a couple of examples of things that are in process, after many years of discussion, ARCHES has just launched a timed entry system. That it took a lot of time to create consensus around it. We think it's really important because it will improve the experience of the hosting community, and we think it'll improve the experience for the visitor. Likewise, we're also engaged in discussions that started many years ago with Danya in the Springdale area to figure out how we get people out of those high demand activities, such as Angel's Landing. We have a permit system for Angel's Landing now, and we're trying to disperse visitation even to the east side of Zion, where they're building a really thoughtfully planned East Zion access point that I think will serve the community really well over the long term.
That was Vicky Varela, Managing Director of the Utah Office of Tourism. You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. I'm Anthony Scoma. On this program, we record and broadcast the many engaging lectures, debates, and panel discussions held at the Hinckley Institute of Politics, and we replay them unedited, mostly in their entirety as a public service. Today, a panel of experts discuss the opportunities and challenges faced by Utah's public lands and the gateway communities that provide access to them. Here again is your moderator, Danya Ramore.
Great, thank you, Vicky, and thank you, many of you, for being wonderful partners over the years. I'm gonna launch into some questions here, which build on what we've already talked about, but I wanna dig a little bit more deeply into some things. And we've raised a number of concerns, so I wanna ask the panelists, where do you think we should really be putting our energy? What are those key challenges or opportunities we should really be focusing on to try to deal with some of these challenges, the increased pressure? And again, you can riff off of something you've already said. And Brian, since you're sitting right next to me, are you interested in going first?
Sure, that'd be great. I think, first of all, we need to think about it and about what we really want, because I think oftentimes the economy will drive certain outcomes. And right now you're seeing a visitor economy that is really demand heavy on a few areas without understanding that there is a bunch of supply in really special areas other places. One of the things that we as in state parks have been trying to do is to say, hey, we understand that it's really increasingly difficult to get into Zion National Park. It might be kind of cool to go to Snow Canyon State Park. It's not the same, it's different, but I would tell you that most people that are not from the area would have a marvelous experience at Snow Canyon and would be able to get out and do the things they were looking to do in Zion without the same size of crowds. And if those crowds increase in Snow Canyon, then we have a variety of other places in the area where we could push people to, whether that's on state land or a state park or whether it's on other federal landscapes. When I worked at BLM, I was absolutely amazed at the type of amazing landscapes the Bureau of Land Management manages, and it's unheralded. Some of the coolest slot canyons in the world are not in a national park. They're in the Bureau of Land Management managed lands. Now, there's always a balancing act there, and the balancing act is, if you point everyone to your favorite spot, it ceases to be your favorite spot because then you have the same problems. And so really we have to put that thought into it, decide how we're going to manage it. I am concerned that there is a tendency to say the grand solution is we'll just keep access limited. We're just not gonna let people in. And I'm not sure that accomplishes what the National Park Service was set up to, is if we're talking about national parks, and it's certainly not what public landscapes were generally intended to be. And so trying to figure that out and trying to do it in a way that both balances those ecological concerns with that demand to be outside and be recreating and doing the things that I think all of us love to do is really gonna take some thought and some challenge.
So I'm gonna open that question to others on the panel. Before I do, I wanna highlight one thing that stood out to me from what Brian just said, and my students in the classroom or in the room here will know that this is a common refrain for me, which is we need to focus on where we wanna go, the path we wanna take, not all the trees we don't wanna hit. Yep. So for you mountain bikers and skiers, you know, if you look at the tree you don't wanna hit, you're gonna hit it. And I think that's often been part of the problem with these conversations is we're just like, oh, we gotta manage this problem versus what does it look like to have a thriving gateway region. And I hear part of what you're saying, Brian, is we need to be thinking that way. And I do know there's this tendency to say, let's focus on dispersal. But if you don't do dispersal wisely, you just create more issues in more places. So a few things that I'm hearing.
And there are some places that can't handle those crowds.
Absolutely. Or right. we could maybe make them so they can handle those crowds if we decide they're appropriate for those crowds. Anyone else want to riff on that? Yeah, Betsy.
Yeah, and I think Brian was right on, and I kind of want to build on that in that we need to do some hard work kind of at the local and regional level to define what our desired conditions are. Like, where do we want to get to in terms of, you know, visitors, but also in terms of the environment? What do we want to protect? What, you know, our biologic soil crust that we need to protect, or, you know, our species that we need to protect? Water quality, what are we trying to get to with this visitation? You know, what's our kind of best possible situation, and work together to get to those desired conditions?
Yeah, just along those lines, there's, you know, there's back country and there's front country. And a lot of what we're talking about with regard to the impacts on gateway communities goes to what I will call front country, which is kind of like Arches. And certain parts of Arches National Park, like the Devil's Garden area, I mean, you go there and it is like Disneyland. But there are other parts of Arches National Park that are more remote and harder to get to, and it takes more effort to get there. And so I think when we think about recreation in public lands, we need to frame it in that way, because there's more that, like, the climate crisis is real. And in order to protect human existence on this planet, we're going to need to not go to some places, okay? Or we're gonna have to work really hard to get there. Like, we cannot allow off-road vehicles to run amok everywhere on our public lands and have any hope really for the future, but also we're degrading the public lands when we allow that to happen. And so we're gonna have to make decisions about growth and about how many people go where. And those can be like tough decisions, but we're doing it on behalf of the greater good and the greater good for the planet.
The most important thing that we think about in our office, and that I would challenge all of you to think about, is that we are all stewards. We have to go into these beautiful places, which I'm sure most of you do, with a sense of stewardship, with a sense of understanding everything from crypto soil to, as Dita points out, the severe impact that OHVs can have on the environment, and to learning to be diplomatic ambassadors for stewardship with other people who may not understand. You know, the example of archaeological vandalism. These are outdoor museums that we will never be able to put ropes around all of the spectacular archaeology, petroglyphs that have been there for thousands of years. The only way these places can be protected is for us to be good stewards, to communicate to others if we see reckless behavior. We put all of this in the Utah Office of Tourism under the umbrella of Forever Mighty, keeping these places forever mighty.
So building on what everyone just said, one of the things that I've been really hearing and what the panelists are saying, something I firmly believe, is that we all have to be part of, as I put it, the problem-solving enterprise, right? Everyone has a certain responsibility, whether that's educating others to be stewards ourselves. I'm curious to hear from the panelists, how do you think we're doing in terms of mobilizing lots of people to be part of the problem-solving enterprise? And especially when it comes to getting people working together, you know, what are we doing well, or could we maybe put some more energy? Does anyone have some thoughts? Take a moment to think.
Well, I'll just say, you know, the problem from my perspective is that we have a state legislature that is not taking this seriously. You know, they're busy right now getting ready to litigate against the reestablishment of Grand Staircase, Escalante National Monument, and Bears Ears National Monument. They're going to spend our tax dollars fighting against the protection for those places. And that's a big problem. I mean, everyone here sounds very rational, right? But when you go to the legislature and try and talk about public lands issues, it really comes down to, for them, it seems, like development and money and who's going to make the money and who's going to, you know, who's going to take the resource and use it to make money, whether that's building things or bringing tourists in or extracting things from public lands. And that is the wrong approach for the time, this moment in time in human existence when we are facing the most profound crisis ecologically that we've ever faced as a species. I mean, whether, you know, if whether our children are going to be able to enjoy the places that we now enjoy is a real question. This is beautiful spring weather, but do you all remember last summer? Do you remember that smoke from those wildfires? That's going to happen again. That's going to happen again this summer. And the reason it's happening is because we're in a climate emergency. And we need legislative leaders who understand that and will act accordingly. And that is not what we have in Utah. I'm sad to say that, but we have climate deniers here, unfortunately.
So one thing I want to note as a conflict resolution professional is I think disagreement is an opportunity to learn. So if people have different perspectives, feel free to share those and we can add or go in different directions. Ryan?
I mean, I'm not here for a public debate on these issues. And there may be a time and an opportunity for that to happen. I will say in defense of the state legislature, I agree sometimes there has not always been a great vision. I will say that I've worked in the state for the last 3 years. And I will say that there's been historic investments in these types of problems. Last year, in the last legislative session, not the one that was this year, but the previous year, invested over $100 million in public spaces in the form of state parks, both to set up two state parks, both in East Canyon, Lost Creek, Lost Creek, which is up by Morgan, as well as Utah Raptor State Park. And just a bunch of investment in that. This past year, they invested $240 million in water conservation to install secondary meters. And so I don't think that their heads are entirely in the sand, as has been represented. I will say working with the state legislature and working with any government agency is always a problem. It's always something you have to think about, why people are having the opinions they're having. And I will say that there's been a lot of demand for some of the things that I know the DITA would disagree with, whether that be on the extractive mineral side or whether that would be on whatever lawsuits the state does or doesn't pursue. And that demand comes from also a rational place. And so I don't want you to think that we can totally discount that as crazy, but have a conversation rather than a debate.
I appreciate that. Always a fan of dialogue, not a big fan of debate.
Yeah.
And I do want to just build on what you're saying and come back to that idea of everybody has to be part of the problem-solving enterprise. I don't think we can point the finger at anybody and say it's their fault or their responsibility. I think we all need to accept responsibility for these complex public problems. And I will just remind folks that there's this tendency to either think of change as top-down or bottom-up, and it's everything all the time. Right. So if you think things need to happen at a policy level, those of you here studying policy, think about what you can do to help mobilize that. And also, you know, we're out there recreating or enjoying these communities or staying in a short-term rental in one of these communities. We need to think about the impacts our decisions are having. So I just, nobody's off the hook, as my students in my classes get to hear all the time. Anybody want to build on that? And again, just how are we doing? What are we doing well? What can we do better in terms of really trying to get people working together on these problems?
I think, you know, just for me and what I've seen, because I work on a more local community level, getting down to that level, people kind of recognize what the issues are in their community and they want to, you know, identify that issue of mutual concern and figure out what everyone's interests are and try to work towards a solution. It doesn't always work out great, but sometimes when they can all identify, like, hey, this is what we really need to tackle here. We have an increase of social trails, or you know, we have damage to this site that we all love, and they can kind of come from it at, you know, come from a, that perspective and work on it together. They can accomplish some pretty good things. And I think the Zion region has been mentioned a number of times, but there's been some really cool sort of efforts down there with a lot of different entities, Washington County, State Department, you know, National Park Service, BLM, private, the McClaws family, who has that land on the East Zion side, who are putting in a lot of effort to build trails there. And that means, you know, hey, if you can't get your reservation for Angel's Landing, you can go maybe bike, you know, on the East Zion side. So, you know, in that sense, when you kind of have this one area that everyone cares about and they're all invested in working towards it, you can kind of get to some cool solutions out of that.
Thank you.
I'm just going to acknowledge that Moab is a very challenging community because too much happened with too little planning. Mm-hmm. And then everybody was pretty mad by the time thoughtful conversations were taking place. And so you're all at the beginning of making your contributions in the world. And I'm going to say, building on Betsy's comments, that lean into what's going on in your local communities. Raise your hand, engage in the conversation, because I love the way Danya frames it. We need to be problem-solving machines, and the only way that can happen is by having these thoughtful conversations before problems get out of hand. We are looking for ways, you know, it's interesting how one or two courageous people can change the conversation. And I see a handful of courageous people in Moab that are starting to change the conversation. One of them is a superintendent, where she's been willing to go in and meet with people with really diverse points of view. That was facilitated by the State Public Lands Policy Council, who came in and worked with her in conversations in the community to get us to this point of the timed entry. You know, so that's an example of where we're starting to find our way to more thoughtful conversations. Something I'm enthusiastic about, Betsy's reference, the Zion Regional Collaboration, which has been really effective. But think about Carbon County reinventing from being a coal community and figuring out how they're going to take advantage of the spectacular place that they live, the recreational offerings there. And next time you're driving south, stop in Helper. It's a beautiful little community. It was called Helper because that's where they added a helper train on to get the coal up the mountain. They are now reinventing very thoughtfully into an artist community, visitor economy. They're cleaning up their river. They're going about creating that destination in a really thoughtful way with assistance from our team. 10 years ago, we didn't have what we call destination development. Today, we have a destination development team led by Bianca, who's here with us today. That helps to figure out how to engage people in thoughtful conversations so before everybody gets mad.
And I'll just throw in one more example you may not be aware of. You may. Emory County was a sister county to Carbon County, oftentimes had a fair amount of land use conflict. They got together in a collaborative process and came up with a lands bill that ended up in real creation of Big W Wilderness. So no motorized, no mechanized wilderness, but in addition, allowed the county to have some of the resources they wanted. Locally, it's always been controversial, but it was a ground up development where there is that collaborative approach. And I think that we'll need to see more of that statewide.
That was Brian Steed, Executive Director of the Utah Department of Natural Resources. You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour. We'll be right back. This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. I'm Anthony Scoma. In this final segment, the panel takes questions from the live audience.
Okay, so we're talking about public lands. I only heard indigenous interests mentioned once by Betsy. So I was just wondering what you guys are doing to work with indigenous communities to kind of return land and food sovereignty to those communities, really the rightful owners of the public lands.
Thank you for that question. It's actually something we talked about before the session. I'm going to maybe reframe that question just to ask, you know, how are we working with our tribes, with our indigenous communities? How do they come into this puzzle?
If I can just go back to the Jemez Mountain example, because it's, you know, the Puebloan people are all around there, you know, we have to work specifically to consult with the tribes, like the Forest Service has, that's part of their, you know, they have a responsibility to do that consultation. But we're also, you know, working with some nonprofits and some other just people who live in that area to kind of like, well, you know, how do you use this area? Why is it important to you? What are you concerned about? And using that to really frame kind of, you know, I'm talking earlier about the desired conditions, but like where do we really need to say, hey, we need to protect this area here because it's a high density site with a lot of, archaeological sites, cultural sites, it's burial sites, it's places where it's not only where they experience their history, but they're using now to gather herbs or whatever, and they take their children up there to say, hey, this is your future, and you know, we care about your future, we want to protect it for you. And so for that one, it is very much kind of, I mean, that's a huge part of what's leading the conversation. I think in Utah, I don't know, do you guys have experiences in involving the tribes in your planning processes?
We work closely with the Native Americans in southeastern Utah, and we're working to provide scholarship programs for those that are interested in building out their guide and outfitter business, other related businesses that affect the visitor economy. So we just sponsored a guide and outfitter out of San Juan County in a scholarship program to figure out how to thoughtfully expand his business. And then related matter, we've just enlisted an EDIA advisor that's helping us rethink everything from the way our team is organized to our marketing strategies to ensure that we're being thoughtful about engaging with diverse communities.
And I say, yeah, I would say the state, we have to do better. I'm not going to say that we've done everything right. Obviously, there's a terrible history there. I will say that we do work with the tribes quite frequently. Water has become a very, very pressing issue. And recently the state entered agreement with the Navajo Nation regarding tribal water rights with the Navajo Nation. I think you'll see some news on that in the very near future. And then on wildlife is a perennial thing where tribes are given, I don't know, probably not a lot of hunters in the room, but every hunter has a license, and then also you sometimes draw out a tag for where you can hunt. Tribes have the ability to hunt in their ancestral areas by federal law, and so trying to figure out how to deconflict those two has been something that's been a work in progress for a very long time. We're working with the Northwest Band of the Shoshone right now trying to work out one of those agreements. So I would say, yeah, we need to do more.
And again, just to highlight another very important stakeholder in our gateway regions, and just to drive home so many different needs, concerns, interests we need to think about, and people we really need to get working together. And unfortunately, with some of those communities, there, as we say, ghosts in the room that make it that much more difficult. And we need to be real and serious about those. And I think there's good work underway. And as Brian said, well, like there's more we could do. I think that's maybe a good framing for our overall conversation today, right? Really good things underway and more we're going to need to do. So with that, I am mindful of time. I want to give each of the speakers just a minute to kind of conclude with some last minute nuggets, key takeaways, pieces of advice you might have for all of us here in the room based on this conversation today.
I'll go, then Dita can respond to me.
Yeah.
I would say this. Public lands are one of the most controversial things that you all are going to deal with in your lifetimes, in part because there's a ton of demand for a bunch of different stuff and a bunch of different interests on how we best proceed on that. I will say this, in terms of my call to you all, is I'm a bureaucrat, and I sit atop of a land management agency. I've sat atop other land management agencies before. We cannot do what we do without substantial involvement from the public. Because ultimately these are, I mean, if you go to every Bureau of Land Management lands, they say your public lands. That's true. These are your public lands, and so the rules that happen there, we have to have input from you all, because otherwise it's left to people that may not understand your interests in doing that. And so my call to action on you all is simply that: be engaged, be mindful of the things that are going on around you, and fight for what you believe in. And I promise you, probably on a political scale, I might not agree with some of the things that you all believe in. I do believe very, very, very vocally in the ability of you to voice your opinion and me to voice mine. And so that ability to have a dialogue and that ability for the public writ large to decide on those public spaces, I think is really important.
Thank you. So I agree.
Dang it.
These are very complex issues, and it's very, very important for everybody, for all of you to be engaged if this is something that you care about. And you know, you heard me complaining about the legislature. Well, if we want to change that, then we absolutely need to be engaged in the electoral process. And this year is an election year. All of the members of the Utah House of Representatives are, if they're, you know, running for re-election, that's happening this year, or in some cases there are new people running. You should ask those folks what, if you care about these issues, you should ask those candidates what their positions are, because the only way that we will change things at the legislature is if we all engage and ask for that change.
Thank you. Vicki, Betsy?
Do you want to go ahead, Vicki?
I can keep it really short to just say, be a good steward and join the conversation.
Yeah, I think that's great. And I guess I'd also just say, work on relationship building and building partnerships, and wherever you end up with, you know, kind of your career and where you're going with that, talk to folks and see where they're coming from, learn their interests, see how they might align with yours or don't. And, you know, we need to all be working together, so build those relationships.
Perfect. With that, thank you to the panel for all the work that you do, not to mention being here today. Thank you all for taking the time to learn about these issues. I'm going to just reinforce those final points, right, of taking responsibility for your own actions and choices, being a good steward, modeling good behavior for others, and thinking about all the different ways you can influence these issues related to public lands and gateway communities or other issues that you care deeply about. Like I said, we all have to be part of the problem-solving enterprise. And I really just encourage you all to feel empowered by that, but also to carry that responsibility.
We're wrapping things up there. If you'd like to hear the full forum, you can find it on our website, kcpw.org. This program is made possible in part by the Hinckley Institute's Wayne Owens Fund. I'm Anthony Scoma, your producer and host of this program. As always, thanks for listening.